This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the treatment of cataracts with ophthalmologist Dr. Natasha Dang. We'll learn about the dangers of AI psychosis with psychologist and author Dr. Addie Jaffe. We'll find out how to support back-to-school health with naturopath Dr. Riley McGregor. And lastly, we'll discover what to do when you have gut symptoms despite clean tests with functional medicine practitioner Joanna Hase. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. A new study from King's College London suggests that people in the UK who follow a Mediterranean-style diet may have healthier gums and less gum disease. This diet includes a lot of plant-based foods like fruits, vegetables, legumes, and olive oil, and is low in red meat. Researchers studied 200 hospital patients by examining their teeth, taking blood samples, and asking questions about their diets. They found that those who ate more red meat and fewer plant-based foods had worse gum disease and higher levels of inflammation markers in their blood. On the other hand, people who followed a Mediterranean diet had lower levels of these markers, which may help reduce inflammation in the body. The study, published in the Journal of Periodontology, shows that what we eat could affect not just overall health, but also gum health. Experts believe that plant-based diets may help lower inflammation because they contain more nutrients and healthy plant chemicals. While more research is needed, this study shows how eating a balanced, healthy diet might help people improve their gum health and prevent disease. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Natasha Dang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. Dr. Natasha Dang is the medical director of Oakville Laser Eye Center and a leading expert in laser-assisted and refractive cataract surgery. A fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, Dr. Dang is known for combining cutting-edge technology with a deep commitment to personalized patient care. She's also a respected voice in the field, contributing to the education of her peers and advancing surgical techniques. At the forefront of vision correction, Dr. Dang leads her team with an unwavering focus on patient safety, outcomes, and experience. Welcome back to the show, Natasha. How are you?
I'm good, Jamie. Thank you for having me back. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so we covered some other stuff before. We're doing a new topic, which is right in your wheelhouse, and I know you're excited about it today. We're going to talk about glaucoma. Many people have heard of glaucoma, but aren't sure what it really is. Can you explain for those who don't know?
Sure, absolutely. So glaucoma is a big part of what I see. It's probably a big chunk of my practice. And essentially what it is, it's a eye condition or group of conditions, actually, that are pressure sensitive. So it's essentially changes in the optic nerve, which is the cable connecting the eyeball to the brain, that are sensitive to pressure. The changes are kind of common between all of these sort of conditions where there's characteristic structural and functional changes that you see. And glaucoma typically starts from the outside in. So you can almost picture an optic nerve being squeezed by pressure and losing its function from the outside in. And so the vision changes are kind of donut-like, where you lose the outside vision first and the central vision is spared until relatively late in the game.
Is glaucoma just about eye pressure, though?
Great question. It's not purely about eye pressure, but what's important about glaucoma is that it's an optic nerve problem that is, responds to or is sensitive to eye pressure. But you can have high eye pressure and have healthy optic nerves without having any glaucoma, which is a good situation to be in. But you can also have normal eye pressure and have glaucoma without realizing it.
So are certain cohorts at risk of getting glaucoma, or is it just sort of a random affliction?
Glaucoma, certain types can have a strong genetic component. If you have a family member, particularly a first-degree family member, like a parent or a sibling who has glaucoma, you are absolutely at higher risk than the general population. It's not, you know, it's not a sentence that you're going to get glaucoma, but you should be screened and you should be a little bit more vigilant about it because your risk is higher. There are also some people, particularly people who are farsighted and who are of certain like demographics, for example, Asians and South Asians are particularly high risk for a condition in which the channel inside the eye that controls the eye pressure is too small and puts them at risk of developing glaucoma. It's a different type of glaucoma, but it puts them at risk. And what's interesting about this group of people is that if you identify this risk factor, you can actually treat it, correct it, and they never develop glaucoma.
So, oh, wow.
So there's a couple of different groups, I guess, if you think about.
What about lifestyle choices? Does that actually impact the possibility of getting glaucoma?
Things about your lifestyle can increase your risk of developing glaucoma. They may not be choices. They may sometimes be things that happen to you or are a result of other conditions that you have. So somebody who has sleep apnea, for example, I've never used one, but I hear from patients, nobody really seems to like wearing the CPAP devices.
Right, yeah.
It's important to do because otherwise you're not getting enough blood flow to your optic nerve at nighttime.
Oh.
And that can result in glaucoma, actually. It results in glaucoma with normal eye pressures. And so that's a tricky one. Some people have to be on steroid medications, like particularly steroid eye drops, steroid eye creams, steroid nasal sprays. Those can all increase eye pressure over time and they can lead to glaucoma if you're sort of on them for too long. There's other situations as well where you can develop glaucoma. And I think this is one that people don't necessarily realize. You and I both like sports. We like to play sports.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to get bumped in the eye, get a ball in the eye, something like that. If that happens to you, it is important to see your eye doctor to make sure your pressure hasn't gone up because that bump to the eye can damage some of the structures in the eye that control eye pressure.
Can we circle back to the use of steroids in and around the eye area? Is it because the steroids relax the muscles? Is that what's going on? Is that why there's, you tell me actually, why steroids impact it?
Steroids increase eye pressure.
Okay.
And in some people, they'll increase it more than others. And longer durations of exposure and higher intensities of exposure are greater risk for it. It's not to say you shouldn't use steroids. If you've got a sinus problem and your doctor needs you to use nasal steroids, I want you to breathe. I want you to use them.
Yeah.
Maybe just check in with your eye doctor to make sure your pressure is okay.
Yeah, I was really just asking for myself there.
Okay. Fair enough.
How do we know if we have glaucoma? Because, you know, you mentioned off the top that it's kind of donut shape and the vision is affected around the periphery at the start. I would imagine that's probably an area where you might not notice it.
By the time you realize you have glaucoma, it's very, very late. It's too late almost. Glaucoma, like I said, is very much a disease of the side vision in the early stages. And it's insidious because there are no symptoms. And most forms of glaucoma are completely asymptomatic. Painless. You don't feel any different. You don't see any different. You don't look any different visibly. It's really only caught through screening exams.
Okay, so that was my next question. Presumably, if you go for your annual eye exam or however people go now with the government cutting back on funding, obviously the health practitioner can test for that, I would assume, right? That's one of the things they look at?
Your optometrist and your ophthalmologist can absolutely and should absolutely screen you for glaucoma. It's one of the big reasons, actually, that we recommend eye exams for otherwise well people who have no ocular history. We recommend usually every 1 to 2 years.
Right.
If you've got a family history of glaucoma or some other risk factor, I'll often see you more frequently, like every 6 to 12 months.
Right.
But for the average person, being checked 1 to 2 years is, I think, sufficient.
Okay. So what should somebody do if they notice changes in their vision? Does that, like, assume that they're in a stage of glaucoma or like, and what kind of changes should we be noticing?
With glaucoma, you're not really going to notice changes in your vision.
Okay.
And with glaucoma, we're always trying to catch it we're trying to catch it earlier and earlier in the disease course. It's really about screening and early detection. When I'm in the clinic, the analogy I always use with patients is I say, it's like picture a stone or a boulder rolling down a hill. If you try to stop it at the top, it's quite easy to do. I can stop it even. You know, I'm not the strongest person. This isn't a video, but right. I can stop this boulder. Midway down, it's moderately difficult now to stop it. Maybe you can stop it, but I can't.
I don't know. You're giving me too much credit. Yeah.
And then at the bottom, like it's run away from you. You can't help that. And a lot of patients, like when I tell them, like, look, you have glaucoma, or I'm monitoring you for glaucoma because you're at risk, they ask me, well, what's going to happen? Am I going to go blind? Right? That's always the question. Even if they don't voice it, that's the fear. And I always say that, look, the outcomes in glaucoma in decades past are different than what they are now, because with good screening and early detection, we can catch it when it's incipient, like it's on the cusp of forming, and right. we can really not entirely stop it in its tracks, but really, really slow down the rate of progression and alter the trajectory of the course in most cases.
So let's switch gears and talk about treatment. How is glaucoma treated today?
If you have glaucoma, whether you have normal pressure or high pressure, we start by treating pressure. We know all forms of glaucoma are sensitive to it. And so even people who've got normal eye pressures do better, and their nerve feels better and is healthier at a lower number. We can bring down eye pressure usually through medical treatments that we do in the office. And so there's a couple of first line therapies that we can start with. So one form is eye drops. Mm-hmm. The other is laser treatment. Both are, you know, equivalently good options. I would say it's something, you know, we sort of discuss with the individual, and there's different reasons we might pick one over another in somebody, but that's kind of the mainstay of therapy. Some glaucomas that you can't control with eye drops and laser may require surgery. I find that's maybe less and less common, as, like I said, we're catching things earlier. And then there's also the situation where you've got somebody who's well controlled for many years on drops or laser. Eventually they develop a cataract. Most of us develop a cataract as we get older. And in glaucoma patients, we really look for and try to identify that cataract early. We like to treat it early, often, because what it does is it gives us an opportunity to treat the glaucoma at the same time.
When you talk about treatment by laser, like, are we talking about, is that a regular thing where you'd have to go back numerous times in order to deal with it? Or if you have the laser treatment, you're good for however long?
It's a laser treatment where you come into the office for typically two sessions. Mm-hmm. The way I do it is 2 weeks apart. You come in, you get a numbing eye drop. It takes a couple of minutes. You hang around in the office for about an hour. Typically, you drive yourself home. You go back to work if you want the same day. Come back 2 weeks later. And we do the part two of the treatment, which is the same thing. And usually, you're not doing this again.
Oh, okay. So one-shot deal, theoretically.
Two-shot, I guess.
Two shots, yeah.
Yeah.
You're a literalist. Okay. Is this considered preventative medicine or not? Or are there preventative medicines that we can utilize?
Sometimes. So some of what we do in glaucoma is preventative. And I think that's really like the narrow angle, doing laser treatments for that. That's very much preventative. So much of it is around early detection and early intervention. Rather than, I don't know if there's things you can do to truly avoid glaucoma or prevent it, but obviously having a healthy lifestyle, avoiding toxins or limiting toxins to the optic nerve. So things like smoking, alcohol, optic nerve doesn't like that. Maintaining like healthy habits is always a good thing.
Is there anything we can do at home to protect our eyes other than living healthy?
From a glaucoma standpoint, people often ask me, are there any hobbies I should do or shouldn't do?
Yeah.
I had one lady who was her vocation was synchronized swimming underneath the water.
Yeah.
She's probably exposed to some elevated pressure.
With the goggles.
Not even just with the goggles, but being underwater. Somebody who's doing a lot of like deep sea diving.
Yeah.
They really have to do these things professionally, and you've got to do them for a lot of hours for it to have any impact. People who play in orchestras and you play a wind instrument and are breath holding all the time, those are all activities that can increase your eye pressure. Usually patients ask me, do I need to stop these things? And I will say, no, as long as I can control the pressure and the condition in some other way, you don't need to. And it's quite extreme, like the amount of involvement you need to have in these activities. So for the most part, I guess to answer your question in a short way, you don't need to change your life on a regular basis.
Okay. As we get older, I'm assuming there's a greater chance to get glaucoma. So should those of us over 50, should we be getting checked more frequently?
If you are over 50, you should definitely get an eye exam every 1 to 2 years.
What do most people do? I'm ignorant. I do that, but do most people do that less often?
I think it depends on coverage. I think that's part of it. Okay. So some people are fortunate. They've got good coverage. They've got good access to care. Others often delay care until their OHIP covered exams will kick in. And that's, situational. But if you have the opportunity, if you can get checked, I definitely encourage you to do so.
If I've been diagnosed with glaucoma and cataracts, which you kind of touched upon in a minute or two ago, can I still do cataract surgery?
You can. And in fact, doing your cataract surgery or treating your cataract can actually be beneficial in terms of controlling your glaucoma as well. Mm-hmm. Regular standalone cataract surgery brings down eye pressure, usually by 2 or 3 points. And that for some patients can be enough and can be really helpful. Other patients who need a little bit more pressure lowering can actually do a combined procedure where we treat the cataract and the glaucoma kind of in the same sitting. And that's great because we're always looking to not only control the disease and control the condition, but we're also trying to improve quality of life so that it minimally impacts patients, right? Where I can, I'm trying to avoid someone being on drops lifelong.
Right.
I want to try to find them solutions that are a little bit more durable, and surgery is sometimes a good opportunity to do that.
Okay, let's talk about surgery for a second. So what are some need-to-knows about glaucoma surgery? Like, is it, I presume it's invasive. I presume you're down for a bit. I presume you are under anesthesia. Like, how does it work?
It really depends on what you have done.
Okay.
For many patients, the patient experience is actually not too different from cataract surgery, which is like coming in, IV sedation, you're not in the operating room for too long, recovery is actually quite quick. This is for the more minimally invasive surgeries.
Right.
Where it does differ is if you need kind of standalone cataract surgery, a cataract surgeon like myself will perform that. If you need combination surgery, a glaucoma surgeon will perform that. And that's typically not done in a hospital setting, not always, but typically. So there's a little bit of variances in terms of how you access the care. But I'd say the recovery and outcomes are actually pretty similar in terms of vision. One important thing, though, that I do emphasize, because a lot of what I do is also refractive cataract surgery. So one thing I always tell my glaucoma patients is, if you're having cataract surgery, this is also an opportunity to maximize your vision quality. We know people with glaucoma don't discern contrast and color as well as someone with a healthy optic nerve. So you want to choose a lens option for these patients at the time of cataract surgery that is going to give them the best possible contrast and like crispness to their vision. And that's usually a single focus lens, of which there's a couple of different types.
Unfortunately,
or a few different types, I should say. Sorry.
We're almost out of time. Will you come back next time and sort of expand upon refractive surgery? Because that is your expertise.
I would be happy to come back.
Fantastic. That was Natasha Dang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the dangers of AI psychosis on The Tonic. Does your reflection match how you feel, or are stubborn areas holding you back? At Form Face and Body, they specialize in restoring your youthful glow and sculpting the body you desire so your outer appearance reflects your inner vitality. Visit formfacebody.ca and see how they can help you rediscover your confidence. Call 416-447-6176 to schedule your complimentary consultation and reclaim your vitality. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Adi Jaffe, PhD, is the author of Unhooked and is a world-renowned expert on mental health, addiction, relationships, and shame. The founder of the IGNTD Recovery, a smart, personalized, adaptive recovery system, Dr. Jaffe was a lecturer in the psychology department at UCLA for a better part of a decade and was the executive director and co-founder of one of the most progressive addiction treatment facilities in the country. In addition to his blog on Psychology Today, Dr. Jaffe's work and research have been widely published in both academic journals and popular magazines and websites. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Jaffe. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me back.
So we're getting very topical today. We're going to talk about something that appears to be on top of a lot of people's minds, and that is AI psychosis. For those who don't know, what is it, and is it actually a medically recognized condition?
Yeah, great question to start out with. The short answer is no, it's not yet a recognized psychosis. Essentially, it's a label we've given in media or popular culture for cases where delusions or psychotic-like symptoms center on interaction with chatbots or AI or, you know, even digital surveillance and things of that nature.
Right. And, you know, there have been some very prominent sort of cases of this in the news. I recall reading something in the New York Times about a woman who committed suicide and was sort of had conversations with an AI chatbot about it, even though she was actually seeing a counselor at the time. That was one article I read. And there have been several others about people who've had sort of these feelings that somehow reality isn't real.
Yeah.
Which is kind of scary, right? Because I don't know about you, but I spend probably too much time on social media sort of looking at pages and looking at what AI is producing. Now, to my eye, I can see when it isn't real, but of course it's getting better and better. Do you do any of that personally? Do you see it?
I do. I'll be honest. I'm actually probably pretty good because I produce some of it myself. So I know what to watch for in terms of AI-based content, especially avatars and when it really tries to be human.
Yeah.
What you landed on is something that is really important for people to understand. That is, AI uses content that it finds everywhere to make future content, new content that is based on the old. And in that way, by borrowing from the culture, by borrowing from news, by borrowing from online available information, it makes itself look like it is some of the same, even though it's brand new produced content. And I just want to remind everybody, AI can sound really, really confident and be 100% wrong, right? Yeah. It's called hallucination, right? Yeah. AI hallucinates and just produces fake information because it likes to fill in the gaps, much like children when you ask them questions.
How can interactions with AI or technology trigger psychotic-like symptoms in people? So what's actually happening?
Well, so because AI borrows information from what's available in the culture, what you've trained it to through conversations, it becomes a really, really personal and personalized interaction algorithm, right? And so it provides, you know, oftentimes you hear about, let's say in cults, they'll use readily available information that is plausible as a starting point, as a hook, if you will, to attach other less plausible information to it. And because you've talked to AI before, it can feel like it's reading your mind. It can feel like it's super personal to you. All it's doing is borrowing that past information. So for people who are vulnerable, and we can talk about what that vulnerability looks like, or for people who are undergoing substantial stress right now, AI interactions, by being hyper-personalized, can essentially amplify that pre-existing psychosis and then support or even exacerbate delusions.
And when it becomes personal, right? When you have more interactions with it, it begins to mirror your language and your behavior, right?
And 100%.
And that's what makes it difficult, because we've been trained, I think, since the advent of social media, to actually seek out similar opinions. Like nobody, you know, people doom scroll, but nobody is like looking that hard at opposing viewpoints. Or if it's a matter of opinion, they're not really terribly interested anymore in opposing opinions. You just want validation. And AI can, you know, like, and when I say validation, it could be validation of whatever you're feeling. So it's an amplifier.
100%. And by the way, what you just said is really, really important for people to understand if they want to use, and we can talk about this AI responsibly. But you are so correct, right? If somebody is normally delusional, and we can talk about how to deal with that, but if somebody's normally delusional, they may interact with others who are often not mirroring those delusions, right? Because those other people are not having the same delusions. AI will go for the ride with you. I mean, it will keep finding information to support erroneous data you're giving it, unless you explicitly ask it to disconfirm what you're saying.
Huh. So let's talk about who's vulnerable. Like, who do you think is susceptible to this?
Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit, but let's get really, really specific, right? So first of all, people with a history, personal or family, of psychotic disorders or bipolar disorder with a psychotic feature, they're especially vulnerable, right? These are the same people that we'd be vulnerable when they use drugs to have psychotic breaks, right? It's the same kind of group. Individuals that already have high sleep deprivation, maybe technology addiction, right? They're staying up all night and watching, especially if they're having that mirrored or attached to stimulant use. You know, we know that psychosis can be created from loss of sleep. Anyway, you add to that this AI delusional support, and that can be a big piece. And then people who are already drawn to just seeking out conspiracy theories, or people who already have a pretty loose sense of reality in general, can go down the rabbit hole with AI.
Wow. Okay. You and I, we can see like the subtle indicators that it's not real, you know, like the video that's too perfect, you know, the woman that looks directly at you from the camera, you know, if it's on an Instagram page, all the images seem the same, the mistakes in the foreground. But, you know, as it gets better, it's going to be harder to tell, isn't it? Like, isn't it problematic that AI is actually getting more realistic?
Well, you know, I guess it depends on how you define problems, right? But, I would say it this way. We are getting very near the time frame where, unless the producers of the content are ethical and let us know on the front end that what we're looking at is AI-generated content, it's going to be very difficult for the vast majority of people in society to know if what they're seeing was created by a live human or created by AI.
Okay, I don't even know if it's a question of ethics, because to my mind, there doesn't, to my mind, social media is the Wild West in terms of legalities and
Sure.
responsibilities. You know, like in a typical North American way, we don't do anything about it until it's already a problem, right? Like nobody will,
Yeah.
and you know, we don't like to be regulated, but certainly there are state actors and bad actors. You know,
Of course.
it's not even, to my mind, I just see it being incredibly disruptive.
Well, and think about something else that we should just say out loud once, right? Which is the technology we're interacting with is a technology we have access to.
Right.
Let's be clear that some of those other actors you were talking about have access to better versions of every single tool we have access to.
Of course.
And that's important for everybody to understand, right? And you know, you talked about what makes people vulnerable and what sort of content makes them more vulnerable. And I think one of the things we're going to have to adjust to, and look, we've had to do this before in life, right? The advent of TV brought media that we would have never had access to from all over the world into our homes, and we had to start being better at discerning information. Now, initially, it started with, you know, two or three channels, and then it exploded. YouTube, right? You can go down crazy rabbit holes. The difference here is that while in YouTube, it takes the algorithm time to present you with pre-existing content that somebody else made, what we're talking about now is tools that will learn how you like information presented, and then also be able to create data, create the content that you will then consume.
Yeah, to me, I mean, I don't even, I don't think we're equipped to deal with it. I actually don't think there's a will to deal with it. That's actually the truth. If anything, I think we are being trained to conflate opinion and fact. We live in a world where all of a sudden fact doesn't matter. To me, it's shocking that everybody's slipped into it, but I think we're ripe for it. I think we've set ourselves up. I really do. I don't like being an alarmist, but that's the way I feel. Do you feel that
Sure. I
way?
mean,
Am
look,
I being paranoid, or do you feel the same way?
well, I think one of the things that we are introduced to more now than ever is, first of all, the relative delusion of objectivity. And
Yeah.
even, and I just mean that even historically, right? So,
Yeah.
you know, we talked about my history. I did research at UCLA for over a decade between graduate school and my postdoc, and then teaching. And, you know, the reality is in research, people still have bias. So even in what we look at objectively as science, people choose what they're going to study and whether we like it or not. And there are a lot of hurdles in traditional science to get enough other people to look at your information. You have to present both sides of an argument when you are scientifically oriented and academically oriented, right? That's the expectation. But that being said, there are mountains of data out there. And so you still do choose and select what it is that you present in your paper or to your committee. And why am I saying that? I'm saying it because you know, when I was at UCLA, we talked, you know, my background is in addiction and mental health.
Yeah.
UCLA has a leaning, right? It's a lot of brain science, a lot of genetics, a lot of CBT. So when you study addiction at UCLA, that's what you learn about addiction. When I got out into the world, all of a sudden I went, oh my gosh, there are five, six, seven other schools of thought about this. And the difference, and again, I want to just point out, I think I'm not disagreeing with you. Those of us out there who become lean, like if we're leaning on AI right now, unless we explicitly, and everybody listening right now can do this, unless you explicitly set up, let's say ChatGPT, to also give you counterpoints, because you can. Yep. AI will absolutely do that for you if you just ask it to, right? Every time you give me something supporting my view, give me one or two sources that counter it. If you do that, you will become better using AI. If you don't, you will go down this crazy rabbit hole.
I mean, what's underlying what you just said, and I believe this too, like, you know, for those of Ayn Rand, I don't believe in objectivism. And what I'm hearing from you, you don't either. I believe in a subjective universe, which makes the notion of fact and opinion, it blurs it a bit. So I realize I'm a contrarian, but I think you're kind of saying the same thing, right? Like everybody has their biases. Everybody comes at it from a certain perspective. What is somebody's truth is not necessarily somebody else's. But that doesn't mean you get to conflate opinion and fact. There are, particularly in science, there are objective truths, I suppose.
Yeah, there should. I mean, so the way I talk about it is actually the more differing viewpoints we integrate, the closer we get to the objective truth, right? Because it's different people viewing the reality from different angles. And, and it's like, you know, no single view of a mountain gives you a full idea of that mountain. You need a 360-degree camera that shoots it from every single angle possible. And then, you know, you understand what the mountain truly looks like. It's the same with every fact in life. That's my view. I love that you brought up Ayn Rand. So, by the way, I love the books, right? Love Atlas Shrugged when I was younger. But one of the things, it presents this really simple view of the world. If you produce physical goods, if you produce better efficiency in the world, that is what your value rests on. And sure, that works for a limited subset of people in a specific socioeconomic class who have very specific cultural expectations. And again, just to the point that we're making here, AI will push forward your subjective truth to you as objective, and it'll sound incredibly confident while doing it, even if it's making up completely false data. And that's what everybody has to understand. You can't over index on how AI will tell you whatever you need to hear, and it has access to more data than you ever will. So if you don't purposefully ask it to make you smarter, it'll just make you go further and further down the same path you were heading down.
A fair warning. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I think this is an important discussion.
That was Dr. Adi Jaffe. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss back to school health on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Riley McGregor is a registered naturopathic doctor practicing at the Toronto Apothecary in Midtown Toronto. She believes in an integrated and collaborative approach to healthcare, targeting towards preventative medicine and understanding the root cause of health concerns and treating the entire person. Her clinical focus includes sports medicine and pain management, hormonal health, digestive concerns, and skin health and healing. Welcome to the show, Riley. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, this time of year, even though it's been a very long time since I've gone back to school, or, you know, my kids are just sort of finishing up school, I get, you know, these feelings, and, you know, it's a sort of change in our health that I think that happens when the summer's over. Do you see that with your patients or your patients' kids?
Definitely. Back to school time is very busy. It can be chaotic. And with that can come lots of different health concerns that sort of come to the forefront. I think, first of all, we often think of the classroom as being a hotspot for germs. So kids are getting colds and flus. Kids are also feeling more stressed and anxious about going back to school. So that comes with a whole host of symptoms and presentations as well. And then the parents are busy. So they're stressed about these schedules and going back to work after summer vacation. And all of these things can impact all various aspects of our lives.
So you take an integrative approach to health, and I'm going to sort of reverse engineer. Instead of talking about, you know, the things that we might be taking to help us, let's talk about the things that, you know, we can do to help ourselves at this time of year. So how do you help boost immunity by just making lifestyle choices?
That is a great question. And that's often where I like to start with patients, is with these pillars of health. So those are things like diet, sleep, exercise, and stress. All of them play very important roles in keeping our immune system healthy and helping us to feel our best. And each one could have its own long conversation, but when it comes down to it, with diet, we like to focus on a whole foods diet that has lots of variety and color to encourage a diverse microbiome, as well as enough protein, carbs, healthy fats, and fiber to really round out our whole meal. When it comes to sleep, I like to encourage people to try to stick to a consistent sleep-wake schedule, try to go to sleep in a cool, dark, quiet room to really get the most out of our sleep each night. Focus on daily movement, exercise that feels good. And then when stressors do come up in our lives, we want to first of all identify that. And everyone has stressors, whether that's work, relationships, finances, you name it. But then determining mechanisms and practices that are going to help you manage those stresses. Those are kind of the foundations I emphasize when it comes to starting off on the right foot in terms of our immune health.
Right. So, you know, I come to the apothecary to get some massages from time to time, and I'm on the mail list. And
awesome.
We got the September newsletter, which raised this issue. And, you know, you also talk about some vitamins and nutrients that can help. So why don't we start with probiotics?
Yeah.
And how that fits into the big picture of health?
Yeah, that's a great one to start with. So the role of probiotics, it can be helpful for so many things, but essentially we really want to support our healthy gut bacteria. So our gut microbiome is important for so many processes in the body, from digestion to roles in cognitive function and brain health. It has impacts on skin health, mood, immunity, you name it. There's probably some connection. And so within our digestive tract, there are different classes of immune cells, and these play an important role in regulating our immune functions to help us counteract infections, fight off colds and flus, and just generally keep us healthy. And so to a large degree, these immune cells are modulated by the bacteria that we find in our digestive system. Many of these have really great health-promoting benefits. They can help with not only immune, but inflammatory processes. And when we supplement with probiotic bacteria, or these good bacteria that we want to see in our digestive system, we can help to modulate these good immune functions and prevent the overgrowth of unwanted bacteria or antigenic bacteria as well. So I often like to start off with a good high-quality probiotic that's well-researched to have the bacteria that we want to see in a healthy human microbiome, to help kids and all of us develop a robust gut microbiome.
So there's two schools of thought. There is the, you know, we need specific bacteria, or we need, you know, a broad base of different bacteria. Which camp are you in?
Yeah, I think there's a place for both. I think generally speaking, we do want our microbiome to be very diverse. We want to have different bacteria to serve all sorts of different functions. They all play very unique and specific roles in modulating different processes. So in general, I like to typically start off with a multi-strain broad-spectrum probiotic just for general health-promoting benefits. But then when it does come down to really specific sort of nitty-gritty things, if we're working on a specific condition or we do some advanced functional testing and find some very specific imbalances, that might be a time and a place for a more targeted bacterial strain or probiotic.
Okay. Let's move on to the second supplement that you mentioned in the newsletter, and that's vitamin D. So,
yeah.
You know, I understand how vitamin D would help sort of older Canadians, but you know, in this context, back to school, how does vitamin D play into overall health?
Yeah, so vitamin D is another powerhouse. It plays roles in so many different processes in the body as well. And it's so important for kids as well as adults to make sure that they're getting enough vitamin D. It plays roles in maintaining healthy bones and teeth, supporting the immune system, as we've been talking about, as well as reducing risk of disease, improving mood and energy, all of which are important for all ages. And where we're located, as I'm sure you are aware, here in Canada, it's really not uncommon for people to be deficient in vitamin D, even after the summertime and we've been outdoors enjoying. So I usually suggest fall to be a great time to get vitamin D levels tested, because it provides some insight into where your vitamin D levels are after you've been outside all summer. And then we can dose accordingly if deficiencies are identified, and keep people feeling good into the fall and winter season.
Vitamin D is a very low risk supplement, right? Like there's very little chance that you could take too much, right? Or if you took a lot, that it would be problematic, right?
Vitamin D is generally safe, but it does also come with some risks. It's what we call a fat soluble vitamin, as opposed to a water soluble vitamin. So water soluble vitamins like the B vitamins, for example, if you happen to take an excess of those, your body can get rid of them really easily just by excreting them out in the urine. But for fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin D, it's a lot harder for your body to get rid of any excess that builds up. So vitamin D is actually one of the ones that we want to be a little bit more careful with measuring levels and dosing accordingly. Although it's uncommon to overdo it, it is possible. And when vitamin D levels do get too high, there are some health risks that can come with that. Like I said, it's not very common, and we do generally keep an eye on things so we can dose accordingly, but it is something to be aware of.
Okay. Omega-3s. I know why we should take them, but maybe you can explain, and then maybe you could explain what you should be looking for in a supplement.
Of course. Yeah. Omega-3s are another one of my staples for immune system health, modulating inflammation. They can also play a good role in helping to regulate blood pressure, smooth muscles, a whole host of things as well. So kind of going back to this whole healthy back to school topic, omega-3s are a really great go-to, not only for their immune function, but also for supporting brain health and cognition and helping people be able to feel and think and really work well as we head back to school and back to work. So they contain these specific substances. There's a whole bunch of them with a whole bunch of different names, but in general, they're called eicosanoids. So they bind to specific cell receptors throughout the body, and they help modulate these things like inflammation, immune cell activation, and a whole host of other processes. So when I look for an omega-3 supplement, there's a few things that I look for on the label. I want to look at the source of the omegas, the quality, and then I also like to look at the sustainability of the product. So you can get plant-based omega supplements, but most commonly you're going to be choosing a fish oil. And so with that, you want to also be looking at the form that the fish oils are in. So conventionally, the omega-3 fatty acids are going to be found as triglycerides, which are very well absorbed by the body, or at least more so than more processed or refined fish oils, where you might see that the triglycerides have been converted into things called ethyl esters. So I try to choose fish oil that's in the triglyceride form just to make it more absorbable. And then when it comes to quality, I try to find a brand that has undergone third-party testing. This is to ensure that the quality and the purity of the omega supplement is accurate with what you're reading on the label. And then I also want to look at the expiration date, because omega-3s are prone to going rancid. So that's something to keep in mind. And then I'm also looking to make sure that I'm choosing a product without any extra fillers or additives, artificial sweeteners, things like that. I really try to choose a high quality, pure omega-3 supplement. And then just to touch on the sustainability point, many omega-3 supplements will have information on the bottle regarding their sustainability certifications. So Oftentimes, you'll see a fish oil that might be certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, usually says MSC or a similar organization. So that's just an extra bonus I like to look for in my omega supplements.
Terrific. We have time for one last question, and you touched upon brain function with your last answer. What do you recommend to support brain health? Are there other supplements?
Yeah, there are so many things out there, but I do have a few staples that I often reach for first. First one I'll mention is lion's mane. So lion's mane is a mushroom, and it's often considered the mushroom for brain health. It's great for improving cognitive function, while also supporting a healthy immune system, as we've been talking about. There's some great research on there in terms of its role in helping with the axons in the brain and nerve firing and things like that. But in general, I find people taking lion's mane, and I found so with myself, see an improvement in their ability to concentrate, focus, memory, and overall just feel more productive and well-functioning while they're at school or work. I like to get mine in tincture form and add it to my morning coffee. So that's my first go-to. The next one is actually creatine. And so we often hear about this more in the realm of sports medicine and athletic performance. But there's actually lots of really cool research coming out suggesting that supplementing with creatine can also help with memory, processing time, thinking skills. And it can even help buffer the negative effects of sleep deprivation. So if you do have a late night, you can still be productive the next day. And then finally, I'll mention L-theanine, which is one of my favorites for helping to reduce feelings of stress and anxiety. It's actually an amino acid found naturally in green tea, and it helps promote more of these feelings of calm and relaxation, as I mentioned. So there's also great research around that one and some cool studies around combining L-theanine with your morning coffee to help you feel more focused, alert, and improve your overall mood.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
That was Dr. Riley McGregor. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the primary foods for your gut health on The Tonic.
For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Joanna Heza is a functional medicine practitioner and integrative nutrition health coach. She helps people struggling with fatigue, gut issues, and autoimmune conditions, and she uncovers the root causes of their symptoms when conventional medicine falls short. Drawing on both her clinical experience and her own healing journey, Joanna brings a fresh, holistic perspective that connects science with everyday life. Welcome to the show, Joanna. How are you?
Welcome. Thank you so much. I'm very good. And you?
Actually, today, as I was coming to the station, I was thinking, you know what? I am feeling a little tired. My tummy's a bit rumbly. So this interview is opportune. Let's talk about gut health, because that's a hot button topic. Is when we talk about gut health, are we just talking about digestion?
Well, no, actually, we're talking about so much more than that. You know, often people think about guts and bloating, constipation, or any gut-related symptoms. But, you know, the thing is, gut is about energy. It's about mood, hormones, immunity, sleep, the way you look. It's even connected to your oral microbiome, so your oral health. So I like to think of gut a bit like a mission control. It sends signals everywhere. So it's not just about how you digest. It's how you convert what you digest, how you absorb it, and how you're able to utilize it in the body. But it's not just about gut digestive issues. And it's not about just eating.
Okay. So I was reading a little bit about the work you do, and you've got this concept of primary foods versus secondary foods, which I don't think you mean foods in the sense that most people talk about food. You're talking about something more. What are primary foods and secondary foods?
Yeah, this is a fun one, because every time I make a speech, I have people guess what primary foods versus secondary foods are. And everybody talks about foods like right. protein, carbohydrates. But in actual fact, primary foods are really more related to what's external to our world and what's nourishing us deep inside. And that's more about joy, relationship, purpose, stress management, creativity, spirituality. It's how we navigate this world as a person and what place we want to have in this world. Those are primary foods. They're the ones that really nourishes us deep inside. While secondary food, of course, is everything about what you put on your plate. And that's also very important. But it's well known these days that, and science has really shown it, that if you're lonely, if you have a lack of joy, or if you have, you know, resentment, ruminations every day, that in itself, even if what's on your plate is amazing, that in itself will be able to affect the way that you feel and the way that you navigate the world, healthy or not. So healing essentially is not just about food. It's about restoring rhythm, purpose, and calm to a body that's overstimulated in this world with just too much information, and about just finding our place again. What are we doing here, right? Are we happy in our jobs? Are we happy in our relationships? That really matters. You know, I like to say there's only so much kale you can eat. And that really is the truth, because if you eat a wonderful organic diet with no sugars, you know, like all balanced, but you're completely unhappy at work and that makes you feel tired at the end of the day, well, obviously you're not going to feel so great, and the food can only lead you to a certain level of health. So that's what I mean by primary and secondary food. And they're just both equally important.
Let's contextualize that theory, or use that theory to contextualize gut health. Are you suggesting that in addition to the foods we eat, there are other factors which determine our gut health?
Absolutely, yes. Because, you know, so imagine this, you know, we're not faced with lions, well, except if you live in Africa, of course, but we're not going to be faced by a lion and have to run away from a lion, right? And that initially, it's our survival mode to be able to run away from that lion, find all the energy in the body to run away and escape and survive. But these days, we are constantly stressed, not by a lion, but by deadlines, family, or anything at work or lifestyle related, or even physiological related. We're going to have all this stress that's burdening us. And what that says biologically is that, well, there's no time to rest and digest. There is no time to digest and absorb the nutrients in my food right now. I got to run from my life to survive. Now, of course, like I said, we're not faced with those situations anymore. But biologically, in our biochemistry, the same thing happens. So when we tell our guts constantly, well, there's no time to digest because we have to run away from the lion, well, you can imagine at some point the gut's going to be affected by it. It's going to be inflamed by it. And the lack of digestion will lead to a lack of absorption of nutrients in the body. So essentially, it's that signal that we send to the gut in a lifestyle that, you know, leads us to be too much stressed for too long, and therefore always being in a sympathetic nervous system, which is that survival mode and refraining our body's ability to be in rest and fully digest what we eat. And that's when the gut can be deeply affected by it. And when it's affected by it, it can transcribe in many ways, not specifically digestive, as a matter of fact.
Well, you're talking essentially about the effect of chronic stress and inflammation, are you not?
I'm talking about chronic stress, yeah, absolutely. And a state of calm and joy is a primary food.
Okay.
That would lead you to a rest and digest. A state of constant stress will lead you to inflammation in the long term and make you unable to digest.
Okay, so if that's true, if all of what you say is true, then shouldn't we be looking at the root causes of our stress? Is that modern society?
Well, yeah, we might have to look at that for sure. It's not just modern society, I think. Of course, we are overstimulated by many things. I believe personally that we are doing far too much than what we're actually capable of doing as human beings. Our biology has not evolved as fast as the world has evolved. But I think we have to have an honest look on our lives and see, okay, but yes, there's all those responsibilities that
right.
I have.
Yeah.
But how can I simplify my life in a way that I can remove some of the stress? Can I start saying no to things? Can I leave more space for rest? And often people say, oh, I have no time. But I don't believe that's true. If there's time to scroll on your phone for half an hour a day, well, then you can replace that with rest.
I would reframe that. See, I believe the most precious commodity we have is time. And I think we have to prioritize our time. So I would reverse engineer that. I would say that time actually is scarce, and that is a real problem. And people actually feel like they don't have time to do all the things they want to do because of all the things they have to do, which I think is another way of saying what you're saying. I think what you're talking about is getting rid of the superfluous things that we do that our time sucks. For example, traveling in traffic or doom scrolling, as you say, or sort of passively watching television, if people still do that. My age group still does. Or, you know, maybe you're just on the web. It's the same thing. You know, TikTok is just a shorter version of a 20-minute sitcom. Is that what you're saying? Is that what it boils down to?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. Time is the most precious thing that we have. And we definitely need to learn to prioritize it, to reprioritize the tasks in a way that it serves us deep inside and nourishes us instead of deplete us.
Okay. So, you know, it's easier for me at the stage of my life. My kids are older, you know, as you reach a certain age, you know, wealth accumulates. You do have more time. You feel like you don't have time to enjoy it because you may not be feeling great, but you're kind of there. You probably do have the time. If you were speaking to somebody in their 30s or 40s, which, you know, which I feel is sort of the busiest time in people's lives, how would you tell them to prioritize in order to maximize their time? What would your advice be?
You know, I'm myself in my early 40s and I have a 2-year-old boy.
Okay.
And my husband is a pilot, so he's not home often.
Okay.
So I constantly have to multitask, right? So I can deeply empathize with the lack of time, having to do all the things. But what I think is really important is several times a week, carve some time for something that really matters. Let me give you an example. For myself, I love dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once a week at night, whether my husband is home or not, I'll go to a dance class. So if my husband is home, he'll take care of the kids. If no one, I'll take a babysitter. And it's not ideal, of course, but I will do that because I know it will be time for myself to fill my cup. Same thing with seeing people I love. I will carve the time to do that, and I will actually say no to the things that I know will deplete me, or seeing people who might, you know, take a bit more of my energy and I don't have the energy for them at that specific time. But I will consciously prioritize my week in a way that, okay, I need to spend time with my son, eat well, work, and sleep. How can I organize myself? And, you know, with the modern worlds, I laugh about it a little bit, but ChatGPT can be an amazing coach for that.
Yeah.
To just help you reframe things and just say, okay, well, these are my priorities. Can you help me reframe my life to live according to those and just balance it out a little bit? And then again, Rome wasn't built in a day. We don't, you know, I'm a type A personality. I want to do it all. I want to, but at the end of the day, there's only so much that we can do. So to start small, small things, small steps, to go towards activities and a lifestyle that is more calm, nourishing, and that can help us have more balance and therefore better gut health too.
Well, thank you for taking the time to tell that to our listeners.
Well, thank you so much. I hope to come again soon.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Natasha Dang, Dr. Adi Jaffe, Dr. Riley McGregor, and Joanna Hasen. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter with content curated personally by me will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.